Well, welcome back to DougHammock.com and to our podcast project on rethinking sex education. As we've said, statistics are giving us some bad news that the wisdom of religion in general, and specifically the wisdom of the Christian Church, is not informing the sexual behaviors of our young people. If we believe that we have something valuable to offer our kids, well, our starting point has to be acknowledging that what we're doing now isn't working. So each week on this podcast, I'm posting an episode to get the conversation started, so we could hammer out together something viable and helpful to give our young people. And I hope you'll join in. I hope you'll comment either on the blog page or on the Facebook page. And I really hope you'll feel free to disagree, because actually those comments are usually the most engaging, the most fun. At the end of the project, I'll turn what we learn together into a book, and I'd love to have your input into the process. So let's begin this week's episode titled Margaret Mead and the Sexuality of the Greeks. So, sexuality, we saw in the last episode, is a deep, deep part of us, much deeper than the reductionist version of eroticism that we use to sell stuff in our culture. Sexuality, we saw, is the impetus behind our most primal human desires to create and to connect. If you missed that episode, either subscribe or go listen on the website. Today I want to expand that idea, the idea of a much bigger version of sexuality, as we listen to both the Greeks and what Margaret Mead had to say. The Greeks still stand today in Western civilization as a bedrock of wisdom in our understanding of the human condition. Their pantheon of gods, their rich mythology, they still speak to our core instincts about humanity. You probably know Freudian psychology drew heavily from Greek wisdom. Much of the way that we Westerners think about our humanity was hammered out by them a long time ago. Well, Greek thinking also influenced our early Christian narrative. It's an interesting aside, not the point of this podcast, but it's an interesting thing that the way that we Christians think about the afterlife was more influenced by Plato and by the Greek idea of a three-tiered universe than it was by Jesus or our own scriptures. You can read about that in a book I wrote, Rethinking Our Story. But if you grew up in church, there's a good chance you framed your thinking about the word love according to three Greek words that are prominent in the Christian scriptures. The three words are eros, philos, and agape. Eros speaks to romance and to passion and to sexual desire as that dimension of love. Philos speaks to the strong bond of friendship, the deep attachment and companionship we develop with one another. And agape is often translated charity. It's the love best understood as the love of an elder, the kind of love that is given regardless of the circumstance. In other words, if the beloved is good or if the beloved is bad, deserving or undeserving, no matter. Agape love is simply given and remains a constant because it's an integrated feature of the character and nature of the lover. That's why we see it most frequently in the mature among us, the elders among us. So, if you grew up in church, odds are you heard about these three kinds of love. You also heard about them evolving over our lives in a progressive manner. Eros love would be first on the list, not the lowest exactly, but the most instinctive, the most biological, the most innate. Unlike the other loves, Eros love happens to us. Philos love, then, is a little further along the spectrum in that it is a function of choice more than biology, choice more than instinct, and so it touches on the realm of a virtue because it has a dimension of selflessness embedded in it. And then agape love, we are taught, is the highest form of love. It is the love most like God because it is a love that just is. It's not dependent upon the beloved. It's as constant as the rising of the sun. Our texts tell us that God loves the just and the unjust, and so that shine comes every morning. What I didn't know growing up at church was that the deeply textured wisdom of the Greeks wasn't limited to those three words about love. Intimately immersed in the human condition as they were, they had words for love, rich, textured, layered words, the way that Eskimos have words for snow. They used deeply meaningful words to describe the concepts embedded in the depth of human love. So along with the ideas in those three words, they had at least two more, mania and pragma. You recognize the word mania. It's where we get the word maniac. Mania love, for the Greeks, described the experience that we would call falling in love. It's the can't eat, can't sleep, can't go to work kind of experience. It describes being consumed by the object of our affection. It's not a way of love that has much longevity. I've read psychologists speak of it as short-term obsession, sometimes using the word cathexis to describe it. Cathexis means to lose our sense of bearings and to overly invest our mental and emotional energy in another person. Obsessive mania love would in fact be an unhealthy thing if it wasn't so necessary to keep the species going. If we didn't have this crazy, disorienting, compulsive experience of mania love, we would quite likely be daunted by the demanding endeavor of creating a pair bond that would last long enough to raise children. So the Greeks put it on the list of human experiences, and they put it under the heading love, mania love. Pragma, another of the Greek words for love, speaks to an insight that I've come to appreciate deeply. It's where we get our word pragmatic. And it speaks of love in this sense. We form deep attachments to one another as we're building our lives together. In the very mundane activities of deciding where we'll live, what work we'll do, what we'll eat, where the kids will go to school, who pays the bills, as we figure out how we'll do the grocery shopping, who will call the plumber, how we'll organize the babysitter, as we undertake these daily life mundane activities, and as we do them together, something quite deep and something quite meaningful happens to us over time. The life that we start creating stops being my life, it stops being your life, and the life we begin to create becomes an attached life. It's a new way of living that we can only think of as our life, the life we hammered out together. So in the process of creating shared lives through the ordinary, everyday, routine stuff, the pragmatic stuff, the way we live is then changed. And the wisdom of the Greeks was to call this experience love. To build a life attached to one another and shared deeply with the other. Well, in order to do that, we have to learn how to sacrifice. We sacrifice my life for the other, and we are sacrificed for in return. We have to learn to lay down the language that we understand and speak in a language that the other understands, as they must in turn do with us. We have to learn how to have sex in a way that they appreciate, as they must learn to do with us. We learn to eat and sleep and work and enjoy our recreation in ways that work for everybody. Which means we have to learn to resolve the inevitable conflicts that not living my own life and you not living your life inevitably will create. And that means we have to develop a set of self-awareness skills and self-disclosure skills and empathy skills and understanding skills, all the things necessary to figure out how to create this new life that is ours. Well, that very process changes us. It changes the me that I bring to creating life. And this pragma version of love, acts like a bucket. And it is a bucket that is able to hold both eros love and philos love. Because romantic love comes and goes over a lifetime. Friendship love is tested. It waxes and wanes over a lifetime. But pragma love, the deep attachment that we create with one another because it is formed by building lives that are not mine, not yours, but have become ours, that has the staying power of deep attachment that in many ways, because it's pragmatic, is removed from the dimension of our lives that is emotional. We are as attached to one another as we are to the lives that we have created together. And by tending to this attachment, we create for ourselves a space where eroticism can return through the season. After the natural ebb of our sexy feelings, there is a place that it can come, it can return to when it flows again. It is that bucket of pragma love. We create a space with pragmatic love, with building our lives together, where friendship, that again ebbs through our lives, can return when it flows. And again, the Greeks had the insight to categorize this attachment-creating experience, this joint life-building experience, under the heading love. I was listening to the spirituality podcast On Being recently, and the host, Krista Tippett, was interviewing Helen Fisher. Helen Fisher is a biological anthropologist with a special focus on love and sex and marriage. And in the interview, she complained that we have been lied to by our love songs and we've been lied to by our romantic movies. They're full of messages, she said, that go against our brain chemistry. They tell us that romantic love, Eros love, is the fulfillment of love. It is the end of the movie. It is the point of the song. They tell us that romantic love has staying power, when in fact it comes and goes in the course of a normal life. Romantic love is, in fact, a means to an end, not the end itself. What pragmalove teaches us is that attachment is more stable than romance. Pragmalove places us in stable lives that we build together, and it has more staying power than mania, than eros, or even philos. But as a culture, we overly focus on eros. We don't pay nearly enough attention to tending our attachments. We don't pay nearly enough attention to pragmalove. Our sexual chemicals, Fisher contends in this interview, are not the end that our society tends to make them, but they are in fact a means to an end. These chemicals, they surge through us, and they are powerful. But their power serves a purpose, and that purpose is to help us form deep and abiding attachments. They surge early in the process, and they help us form attachments that, when nurtured well, can last for a lifetime. Chemical love is the way that our brains form attachments, the attachments that we're going to need to weather the inevitably unhappy times. Now, what occurred to me many years ago and has deepened my life considerably is this. This multi-layered Greek word for love phenomenon. What the Greeks were doing was actually describing a developmental process, because one kind of love leads to another, each in turn carrying us along on a journey that goes to a very deep place in the human experience. This journey takes us to a rich and full and satisfying experience of a multi-layered, deeply faceted love. This is very important context. How can our kids think about the fire of their sexual energy without understanding where it is that this is going to take them? Our kids are young. And first up in their young lives is the stage of the journey that is defined by chemical love, by eros love, by mania love. And so they are subject to the strong biological impulse of instinct. They have not yet seen the love process unfold over a lifetime. That's context we must give them. They've only seen the beginning of this movie, not how it ends. Consequently, our sexual curriculum needs to frame for them the whole process, the whole journey. Now, we've seen in the last few episodes that the institution most diligently working to frame a sexual education for our young people is the institution that is trying to sell them stuff, consumerist capitalism. And their agenda, focused as it is on selling, is not looking at the next 30 years. Their agenda is trying to sell stuff today, this quarter, this reporting period. The sex sells curriculum doesn't look to the lifetime over which love and sexuality unfold. Consequently, its focus is on the now versions of love, the now layers of love, like mania and eros. And since the marketers are the loudest and the smartest players in the game right now is what our young people know about sex. Now is about all they know about sex. Now, we're living in a historical moment of sexual and relational upheaval. Our sexuality and our dating and our marrying and our family-making norms are all in a tangle of disorder and confusion. Nobody knows what to do in this time of fluctuating beliefs and values. All the social conventions that once provided guardrails for the young, all those social conventions are being uprooted. And as this tumult is unfolding, the very idea of a progressive developmental process that culminates in a lifetime of love, the very idea that mania and eros would lead us to philos and pragma, which in turn would awaken us to the depths of agape love, the very idea that the love of the elder, love that loves because it has become the nature of the lover, that very idea of a lifetime process has fallen on hard times. In the county I live in, a few years ago, we crossed a threshold. We now have 7 divorces for every 10 marriages that are performed each year. A term that has become popularized in our culture describes how we are doing sex and love and living together and marriage now. The term is serial monogamy. It means that we form one exclusive love and sex relationship, and that relationship serves us for a season, and then it ends. And then we form another exclusive love and sex relationship with a different partner. This sequential pattern has become a norm, one after another after another, and typically it's happening about every 8 years. Now, this is a social experiment, and we've been working on it for about 50 years. And it's an experiment that's being undertaken for some really good reasons. Our whole society is changing, and the change is affecting who we are when we come to love and sex and marriage. We don't live in an agricultural or an industrial society anymore. Upper body strength is no longer the determining factor in productivity. Consequently, males need no longer fill the social role they once did, and females are no longer limited to hearth and home. A male must no longer be the sole provider or play the dominant role as head of the home, and a female is no longer limited to the role of childbearing and childrearing. This is all quite normal for people who are living in our time. But from a historical perspective, it is astonishing. A way of being male, and a way of being female, and a way of being sexual, and a way of being married, a way that has been the way for thousands of years, is going away in about 50 years. And we don't know yet how to move forward in this new world. And who knows how long it's going to take to figure it out. And there's another factor in play here. Life expectancy today is around 80 years, but when the idea of marriage for a lifetime was hammered out, life expectancies were around 40 years. And those 40 years, by the way, were pretty consumed with working the land and with raising offspring. Can the way that we did love and sex and marriage then be sustained for an additional 40 years, which were not consumed working the land and raising offspring as we were? And so we're trying to figure out what a new normal is. And our first stab at finding a new normal has been serial monogamy. Now, as experiments go, it makes sense, but it has also created a few problems. First, when the Greeks defined a developmental process that culminates in the highest love, the love of an elder, the love of agape, that process takes time to unfold. Agape love doesn't form in us in a decade. It takes several decades. And if we don't do the time, the process gets short-circuited. Second, it also takes time to raise children. It takes about 20 years if you're going to have more than one. And with our current trend of staying in relationships about 8, you can see the problem. In this current social experiment we're trying, we don't seem to be able to form the kind of bonds that will last long enough to give our kids the years of stability that they need to get out the door healthy and cared for. About 30% of children under 18 in our society live in a single-parent home. 40% don't live with both biological parents. The way that we are forming our bonds in this new experiment of trying to find a new normal, either that or the stress that we put on those bonds once they do form, whatever the cause, as a society, we are not moving through the developmental process that the ancient Greeks set before us. The longevity and resilience required to move from eros through pragma into agape, our ability to navigate that journey is falling short. Now, Margaret Mead, she was a controversial figure 50 years ago or so. She was an anthropologist and a student of human societies, and she was one of the first to name this shift that is going on in our society. And she articulated how our traditional gender roles were breaking down, and she articulated the ancient sexual taboos and how these two were breaking down. And she broke many of the sexual taboos herself. And she taught us about the social forces that are in play that are undercutting the traditional ways. Now, if Christians know about Mead at all, they usually have a tough time forgiving her for being so articulate in her making a case that upset the apple cart. But she was at the forefront of the way our young people are rethinking morality and sexuality. She was a shaper of the new ways that we think about family, about raising children, about sexuality and gender roles. So like her or not, we Christians ought to be informed about what she said and why she said it. One of her more lasting quotes was that every woman should have 3 husbands. She did. The first one, she said, was to experience a vibrant and youthful sexuality. The second was for security and stability that's necessary to raise children. And the third was for joyful companionship once the kids were gone. Now, if we were to frame her words in the Greek understanding of love, she could have been saying this: everyone should have three marriages. The first to experience mania and eros, the second to experience pragma, and the third to experience philos and agape. Our culture's serial monogamy experiment is working on a different premise than the Greeks. It's working on the premise that these ways of loving are not progressive in nature. In other words, our culture thinks that one does not lead to the other, does not lead to the other. They see them as separate entities. We seem to be working on the assumption that as a relationship grows and as it gets ready to move from one form of love to the next, that is, in fact, time to leave the relationship. And so this experiment we've been doing has, in effect, encouraged us to step back from the developmental process and try and circle around again and try and recapture an earlier stage of love, but just do it with another person. Our experiment has not encouraged us to move forward with the same person from one form of love into the deepening experience of the next form of love. So when we don't think about love from the developmental perspective, we condemn ourselves to stagnation. Our energies go toward trying to recapture a less mature developmental stage, a previous developmental stage, rather than moving forward into a more mature one. And that might be why second and third and fourth marriages suffer ever decreasing rates of success. In our society today, first marriages have almost a 50% rate of failure, but second marriages have a 67%, 2/3 percent failure rate. Third marriage is even worse, a 73%. It's because each one of those bailing out on one love relationship and then trying it again in the next is trying to recapture an earlier stage of love instead of progressing into a more mature expression of love. And that's not the way we're wired. The Greeks understood that. It just doesn't work because that's not the human condition. The sexual curriculum that is being given to our children today teaches them that mania and eros and philos are the sum total of love. But when we ignore the ancient developmental wisdom, we are training our children most clearly by example. We're training our children to go backward in the process rather than forward. The Greek understanding of human love and sexuality argues against our current social experiment in serial monogamy. They knew that mania has a very short shelf life. It burns with a flash, but not much sustainability. They knew that eros, when nurtured, can settle into a slow fire that will burn for a lifetime. However, it only does so when it's supported by the deeper kinds of love. Philos ebbs and flows. Pragma provides a backdrop for the whole process to unfold, but the point of love is to become love. The point of love is to become like God. That's the way we Christians would talk about it. The point of love is to love because we are love. To love because our character and our life has become love. This is where the developmental process takes us. It takes us to this higher form, this agape form of love. That's why in the last episode, we drew such a strong link between our sexuality and our spirituality. Because agape love is its own reward. Agape love, to love because we have become love, is the culmination of the deep yearnings of the human heart. And it is sexuality, deeply understood in all of its iterations, in all of its drive to create and connect. It is our sexuality that takes us to this deep fulfillment. Our sexuality offers us a profound gift. It moves us forward. It moves us beyond our biology. It moves us beyond our profound love, even for our children. It moves us beyond a quid pro quo kind of love, beyond a love that insists that affection be returned in kind. Mead's first marriage draws us toward the second. and her second marriage draws us toward the third. And the third marriage advances us on a process, drawing us ever toward the deeply spiritual place of loving simply because we are loving. But before our current experiment in serial monogamy became normalized, the norm was to have all three of these marriages with the same person. The Greeks help us. They lay out a roadmap for how to do that. And you don't do it just by white-knuckling your way into some kind of forced fidelity. No, we do it by moving forward in the depths of our souls into the next growth stage of love. And we experience that stage more deeply, which deepens our fulfillment of the human experience. And that carries us to the next stage. If genital sexuality doesn't move us forward on the journey, hooking up the plumbing gets pretty dissatisfying after a decade or so. If the Greeks hadn't told us how to move forward in the next developmental step, then once sex gets boring or the fire seems to go out, then it would make sense to abandon the relationship. But the Greeks did show us another way. If parental love doesn't help us become agape lovers, we might as well join the queue who are all getting divorced at the 25-year mark. The kids are gone, our hearts didn't really catch the depths of love, so let's call it quits. But the wisdom of the Greeks was to say that this dismal way of being together need not be our fate. There is a growth pattern. And as we follow that pattern, it breathes life and longevity into our loving, our sexual relationships. Our sexuality moves us forward on a profound and ancient process. And this is a compelling story. It's a story that is profound enough for us to embrace it deeply in our own hearts, and that it is compelling enough for us to tell this story to our children and to invite them into a journey, a long one that culminates in deep and abiding fulfillment and satisfaction and life-making. Agape love, the love of the elder, is the love of giving ourselves away, and it is the most fulfilling dimension of being human. Agape love is the joy of the prayer given us by St. Francis. For it truly is in giving that we receive. It is in pardoning that we are pardoned. It is in understanding that we are understood. It is in loving that we know love. Sex and love are about a whole lot more than love songs or orgasms, and we have to teach this to our kids. All right, so as always, I hope you'll comment. I hope you'll agree, disagree, doesn't matter to me. And again, I hope to capture your thinking into the book that comes at the end of this project. All right, we'll continue next time.